Nancy Perozzo at the Canadian Grain Commission boardroom on July 16th, 2010, with Ian Du at the controls and Mr. Prestai, the narrator for today. So thank you very much for coming in this morning. And in a lead up to the interview, you were mentioning that you're a Saskatchewan farm boy by birth. Well, so perhaps we can start there as how it was the your introduction to the grain industry.
Well, I was born there, but my father worked for the CNR, and he was transferred to Thunder Bay, well, Fort William in those days, when I was about 4 years old. And I lived here off and on, well, since then. I lived other places like Toronto, Montreal, St. Catharines. That's when I was on the lake ships. I worked in the lake ships, and then I was a union rep for the seafarers. But that got to be sort of the unionism got to me that I wasn't exactly totally satisfied with the representation the members were getting, so I decided to leave and pursue another occupation. And do you want me to go when I started with the grains? Is that what you...
Well, let me go back, because there's a few things that you've mentioned that I think we're interested in as well. Your dad worked for...
CNR.
CNR. Yeah. What did he do with the CNR at that
well,
time?
Well, he worked the maintenance away, and then when the ore trade came through, he's from Atikokan, they loaded the ships at the ore docks here, and he worked there until he retired.
And then you said you, was it then you moved to the ships? Was that how you
became? Yeah, well.
How did you get involved in working on the ships?
Well, my brother was on the lake ships, and in those days it was sort of an adventure. And I tried it out for a number of years, even out of Vancouver and the Great Lakes.
And what kinds of things did you do?
Oh, engine room mostly. And then I started with the Seafarers Union in 1966, and I stayed with them until 1975.
And what does the Seafarers
it's the
union rep do?
Well, they're supposed to look after the members' interests, but I think that's a fallacy. It wasn't. So I got dissatisfied with that situation, mm-hmm. So I left.
So do you feel comfortable talking about why you felt they didn't take care of the
well, if you go back, you go back to the 1960 to 61, there was another union trying to get in the Great Lakes called the Canadian Maritime Union. And it got to be a sort of a battle, and there was a number of beatings and shootings in the U.S. and in Canada. And a lot of people got hurt. Quite a few went to jail for life in the U.S. for assassination attempts and that type of thing. And to me, I wasn't wanting to be part of anything like that.
Did the tentacles of that make its way to Thunder Bay at all?
Oh, yes, yes. An agent here, I can't think of his name, he worked for Upper Lake Shipping, which started the Canadian Maritime Union, and he got severely beaten here. In his home, and that was the beginning of things here, and there was a lot of violence here in the local pubs and so forth. It was quite a bit of animosity. Well, actually, with the higher echelon of both unions, the members are the ones that suffered.
So was it the rank and file that were involved in the animosity, or was it more of a...
Well, no, it was the executive of both sides. They always can get some goons to do their work for them. There's always those kind of around. Mm. And that's what happened. And they're both... I think the Upper Lake Shipping still is the Canadian Maritime Union, and the Seafarers do have Canada Steamship Lines and a couple of others, but there's nothing that I know of or heard of. And they've been lately, I guess, they sort of settled their differences. And
they both still operate?
As far as I know, yes. Yes.
Ian has a great interest in history as well, so if I'm not following a line that you think I should, do you want to just pop in with a question? Is there anything? I mean, this is fascinating.
Right. Well, this is from the Hal Banks era.
You got it. You yes. got him. You know the name.
Yes.
You know, Hal the Sailor's Pal.
Yes. So most of the problems were with between the unions?
Yeah. Well, what it was is the Seafarers International Union comes from the U.S., okay? And Hal Banks was sent over here when they had the Canadian Seamen's Union back in the 40s after the war. And I'm not sure, it always was said, but it's before my time, it was communist infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the Americans don't like that kind of connotation, so they came over here to straighten things out and get a... what's the word? I can't think of the word. It slips my mind what the word is.
What's the concept? Get a grip on something or get control?
Well, Canada, U.S., what do we call ourselves?
Trading partners? North?
No, no. Not patriotic, but can't think of the word. We have a... What's the society we have compared to others? I'm trying to think.
Democratic society.
Democratic, okay. I'm trying to slip my...
I know, don't you hate it when that happens?
Democracy, that's what Hal Banks sent over here for, democracy. And he ended up being a dictator. Everything was his way, or that's it, you're out. He threw more people out of the union than he got in. But in those days, you get... there was about maybe 12,000 jobs in the Great Lakes, and the dues income was quite extravagant for people on the top. But Hal the Sailor's Pal left, I think in 1963, back to the U.S. because I think the conservative government was after him, and so were the Mounties. So he retired somewhere to the U.S., wherever he went, I'm not sure. And another thing I just hit my mind in 1968 when I was a union rep, they had a honorary Man of the Year in Buffalo, New York, with maritime trade, that was it. And guess who was the honored person? Hal C. Banks. And guess who the chairman was? George Steinbrenner.
Good old combination.
Yeah, yes. It just hit my mind. I remember attending that dinner. George Steinbrenner and Hal C. Banks.
And George Steinbrenner?
The one that just passed away, yeah.
With the New York
Yankees, yeah. Yankees. He only owned the lake ships then. Yeah, he owned lake ships, yeah.
Oh.
I think it was in 1949 or 50, the Henry Steinbrenner run aground in Isle Royale there and sank. It was one of his ships.
Hmm. Anything else about your time as a union rep that...
Not really, no.
Wow.
It wasn't exactly a pleasant time, that was.
So going back to your time on the ships, you said you worked in the engine room.
Mm.
So I interviewed a fellow who worked in the engine room a generation before you, and he was shoveling coal.
Yes, I did that.
So tell us a bit about the work you did. So when you started?
Hot, dirty, sweaty, going through the Detroit River when it's 105. You wonder why you're doing this. But you did it. I mean, it was something that you did. You never worried about it. I don't know. It's one of those things. You were young. Who cared?
And what was life like on the boat? I mean, other than the work part.
Back then, the ships were, they're ancient. They were only building the new ones then. But I was on some ships where, you know, you're all squatted in one room. And when you went on the ship, normally you got the top bunk. And one of the ships that went on, I got the bottom bunk. I thought, that's really curious. Until lights were out, you could hear the rats knocking over the garbage pails. That's right. Call them bilge rats. It was common. I mean, that's the way it was.
Which ships do you remember?
Well, I was on a few of them. Some Patterson ones and some Upper Lakes ones and Meisner. That's about it. And on the West Coast with the Princess of Nanaimo was on that coastal trade.
Did you have a favorite ship?
Yeah, I was on the New Brandock in 1959, and I was the only English, well, English-speaking person on there. Everybody else was bilingual. And it was, they were fascinated that I couldn't speak French. And for a year and a half, they tried to teach me to speak French. The only thing I still remember is how to order a drink. But they were really nice people. I really enjoyed them.
I reviewed a book by, it's called Deckhand, that's the name of the book, mm-hmm. and it's by an American, and he describes the routine on the ships, and he uses a term, he was a deckhand, not engine room, mm-hmm. but he uses a term sugiing.
There. Yeah, sugiing, you call it sugiing, yeah. You're washing the ship down.
That's right.
Yeah, you use lye and soap, and you wash the white down, you go over the side and wash it all down, it's called sugiing.
Yes.
Decks.
And it's a never-ending job.
Always.
You're and
always
it's a really physical job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, if you're running grain and then iron ore, which a lot of ships that did both, that
yes.
iron ore to get all over, you have to keep it clean.
Yes.
That was part of your job, yeah.
Can you describe your first day signing on? When did you become a sailor?
I don't think I ever become a sailor. Yeah. I don't know, it was just something new. I was on the Renvoil, April 5th, 1956, and it was a package freighter. And it ran from here, the package freighters, well, they didn't have the key for terminal, they ran to the shipyards, at, not shipyards, but where the marina is, they had a sheds there, and he ran there. And I think he ran somewhere up, took papers, Sault Ste. Marie, Sarnia, Windsor, Leamington, Port Colborne, Toronto, Montreal, like he went everywhere. And he carried package freight, which was, you know, they brought everything that came here instead of by truck. It came here, like, you know, anything from, like, liquor, candies, shovels, stuff like that, that would be brought by ship in those days, yeah.
When you talk about all of those things that the packet ships were taking and other ships as well, folklore has it that cargoes tend to be, some of them disappear?
Oh, sure. Yes. Well, I'm not sure so sure about here in, well, Thunder Bay or Fort William or Port Arthur, but in Montreal it was so common. It was common. I guess the security was in on it or something. Because usually with, when you went into the U.S. and you came here, the Mounties would come down and search the ship because you had to sign a waiver. You didn't buy anything. You take it ashore and no one seemed to bother. But I guess, years ago, I read in the article in the paper, they finally clamped down and half the longshoremen and the security are in jail. Well, it's, they had to, I guess. So many things are disappearing. But
since our project is focusing on wheat, anything about transporting wheat by ship that sticks in your mind?
Not really, no. I can't really think of a...
You got to know all of the elevators along the...
Here?
Well, here and also along the seaway?
Well, before the seaway opened in 59, the furthest point you could go to, I think, would be Prescott, Ontario. It was a transfer elevator, and then Kingston, and then Port Colborne. That's where the small ships took them up to the old canal to Montreal to go to foreign ports. But really nothing that I can think of.
An elevator is an elevator?
I think there was about 25 here. There were. But other than that, I don't. Only thing is, I recall is November and December when you were coming up this way was quite chancy because of the weather was quite bad. And I remember one year I was on the ship called the Burlington. The captain was an imbiber, and you get a bonus for more trips that you make in a year. And we left Sault Ste. Marie in a real gale. Remember the city of Windsor was turned on the side. And the captain kept going, and we got caught out in the middle of the lake. And thank God we made it to the part of shipyards. It ripped the front of the hull just about off. You could see in. We're the only ship, a couple of them had the deck split too. They came in here, they're all anchored waiting to get in the shipyards because they couldn't move, taking on water. But those are those days. They had to answer to no one.
I was going to ask that, so no repercussions for taking off. How were you feeling that day?
Well, hard to explain. Half the crew was seasick and some of them were praying. But you know, it's strange when you're young, you don't care, nothing's going to happen to me anyway. That's what you think. Now, I can't swim either, so. And the ironic thing was, on most of the ships, it was a safety thing where you had to lower the lifeboats and test them to see everything was fine, like a lifeboat drill, make sure that, you know, in case that happened. When we got into the shipyards here, they had a lifeboat drill. The lifeboats wouldn't lower, they were seized. So if something would have happened, you had to swim, sure. I don't think you'd do that in Lake Superior, not in those days. But the storms were quite bad. I can remember some ships coming in just leaning over this way with ice because it wouldn't. It just froze. And I guess the heavier Harrier got there'd be sideways. That's a smaller ship, but I don't think there was any really bad ones.
You were on the ships or with the Seafarers Union during when the Seaway opened?
Oh, yes.
What do you remember about that? Changes and...
Well, I was on the New Brundock and we had to anchor and raise the flags because the Queen was coming through with her yacht. That was the first the Iroquois. Remember they passed through, you had to dip the flag for the Queen. That was, 1959, I forget what date it was, but it was sometime in... The Seaway was open, but officially she opened it. Prior to that, with the small canal boats that took grain from Prescott to Montreal, the deckhands walked to Montreal, because there were so many small locks, and they got off to tie up, didn't get back on, you walked all the way there. That's so many small locks they had. I'm not sure how many there were, but that's what they did. So how many miles it is, I'm not sure, from Prescott to Montreal.
Was there any anticipation on the part of the
boat? Well, I suppose with the smaller ships that carried crews of about maybe 20 or 19 or something like that, their jobs would be gone and the bigger ships would go through. So I'm not sure how many went to the wall or got scrapped, but quite a few must have, because that's all they had. And it was tons of those small ships. They had to... Well, I think a big lake carrier, which would take, say, around 25,000 tons, it would take maybe four of those ships to bring that amount to Montreal from a transfer elevator. I think they carried about 10 or so, very small. That's all they had then until they built that.
What about the captains of the ships? Any differences between them? Were they one of a kind, or...?
Well, no, they're all different people. I mean, just some of them that were, I guess, in the Navy were hard to work under because they were spit and polish and they didn't understand that you had a... The ones that come through the ranks, I guess, on the lakes, they understood. Other than that, I just can't recall of any that I disliked. A few that... Maybe a few, but I...
Ones that you liked particularly? Admired?
I just can't think of any. No, I can't recall of any of that.
Would you say that there was sort of a social system on the ship whereby the engine room was one society and the deck another?
No, not really. I don't think so. The crews are pretty well the same. You know, you're in the mess room together and ate together and all that. I don't think there was any, you know. Only thing that we used to tease it, when you were on some of those coal ships that were pretty hard work and sweaty and all that stuff, some of the people who worked on deck, we said they should wear skirts. That's about it.
What was the food like?
Some of them were pretty good, you know, it depended. You know, I'm not sure in those days, a cook was a cook, and some of them were darn good and fed you quite well, and some of them were just probably deckhands before or something like that, and they could make bacon and eggs, they were hired or something, I don't know. Some of them were just terrible. But basically, there were some good ones.
And the food was...
Oh, yeah, it was. So nowadays, in some of the ships, the excellent food, like gourmet food in a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Very good, they're chefs. Well, it's not bad money.
So what decided you to move on from the rank and file into the union?
Well, I don't know. I was asked. I don't know why I was asked. So I said, no, I'll give it a try. So I stayed a few years.
What was the first day like on the job with the union then? Can you recall?
Yeah, horrible. Ontario, it's next to St. Catharines. And in the spring, they have calls for all the ships, like they need crews. And I was a dispatcher to send them all, so I'm not sure how many jobs there were, hundreds of them. And the guy that hired me was my boss. He went to Montreal, left me alone. I had no concept of what was going on. At the sleeping union, I couldn't leave it. That was my first day. And I thought, what a stupid move I made. But I got onto it.
And that's not the job you stayed with at the union. So how did your career progress there?
Well, some people left, and I was transferred to Toronto as business agent. Then there were some moves made here. I was sent here as vice president. I got elected as vice president of Upper Great Lakes. And I stayed for till 1975.
Yeah. What does a agent do, a union agent?
Well, it means, people being sick and whatever, dispatching people to jobs and whatever else, and selling grievances and so forth like that.
When you think of the grievances, can they be put in categories? Like, what was the most common grievance, and what can you remember is the most unusual one?
Unusual. Well, unusual. I'm trying to think of a real unusual one. They had the ship called the Silver Isle. And most of the big ships were built, you had your own room. But on this ship, it was built in Cork, Ireland, and there was two to a room. And these two guys were dispatched out of Montreal. One was Arab, one was Jewish. Wow. I didn't know how to deal with that one. But they hated each other with a passion. So what happened was, I talked to the captain and the chief engineer on there, and I'm not staying with an Arab that washes his feet in the sink where I have to brush my teeth. How do you settle grievance like that? But I guess they hated each other, but they stayed in the same ship for a number of years.
So that was the more unusual one. What were usual?
The wrong kind of soap. They don't palm all over something like that. And then if somebody didn't like the cook, the food was terrible, that kind of thing. And to me, once you got used to it, I said, if you don't like it, go somewhere else. Really, you're getting it for nothing. But normally, if you had grievances that were legitimate, like pay things, all that, you file the grievance and meet with the company, the company official, and you would iron it out, whatever it is, and they would check it out. They'd pay. If not, they wouldn't.
What was your, how did you like that part of the job?
When I got into management, I had a good concept of what to do. Yes or no.
Great.
And most of them are bargaining issues anyway. You gave me one, I'll give you one back. So
a good learning experience.
Very.
Can you tell us about strike situations?
Which ones?
Exactly. Can you give us a history of...
What do you mean, the seamen strike or elevator strikes or which?
Yes, both, but seamen particularly.
Well, a lot of them are pretty violent ones. Some people decided they didn't want to, belong to the union, they wanted to go to work, and they would get beaten and so forth like that, and that type of thing, but I seem to think that way back when I got into the executive, and president, executive vice president knew ahead of time what the contract was going to be, what it was going to be signed as, but they decided to let the seamen blow some air and let them sit on the picket line for 3 or 4 weeks and say, look at what we got you. They knew ahead of time what it was going to be signed, so the guys lost, members lost 3 weeks pay for nothing. That was the system.
Were you part of the negotiating team?
Yeah.
So who would be, who would have been other members of that team, and who would have been, that you recall negotiating with?
Well, most of the bargaining committee members were yes men anyways, whatever you said, they say okay. So there wasn't handpicked.
By the executive of the union?
Oh yes, of course.
And do you remember people on the other side of the table, like personalities? And?
Yeah, with, God, they're all gone now. Johnny F. Meisner, who else? God, I can't think of stuff. With Papa Christides, I can't think of the name. He had a few lake ships. Geez, I can't remember them. Hall Corporation, with.
So would they be like, where would they fit into their company structure? Were they like lawyers or just the negotiating team or the owners?
Some of them were, they had stocks in the company. I'm not sure if some of them, they weren't exactly the top echelon, but they were, they had the power to do it. And I'm not sure if Paul Martin was, no, he wasn't. He was just a rookie in those days, I believe. But, they had the authority to sign.
Are we ready, Ian, to move on to the real grain area, although shipping was one of the areas we were very interested in as well.
Yes. Not very interesting, is it?
Oh, it's fascinating.
Not to me, it isn't.
That's what I find. Most people who live the life don't realize just how fascinating it was. Is, still. So, let's see. We've left you, you were with the union, and then you decided to leave there. So, where did you go from there?
I started with Parrish and Heimbecker, August 31st, 1976.
And how did it come about that you started with them?
What happened was the prior manager there, Jake Burnett, died of cancer. I knew him through, I don't know, I just knew him from, I guess, from being a union rep. And he died, and a guy I curled with when I was in Thunder Bay, Larry Carroll, he was working for Saskatchewan Wheat Pool, and Bill Parrish came down here, him and John Field, looking for Larry. Of course, we're all members of the Elks. And things were so busy, he said, if you want a job, he said, we're hiring. And I said, well, I'll give it a try. I stayed. Started as a laborer.
And who was the Mr. Fields that you mentioned?
John Field was the general manager, yeah.
Okay.
He retired in 1993.
Okay. Is he still?
No, he passed away 2 years ago.
So you started as a laborer. So we'll go back to our repetitive question. What was the first day on the job as a laborer like, do you recall?
Dusty and dirty. That's what you did. You were a sweeper. You loaded refuse into boxcars. In those days, they had they still don't have a pellet mill at Parrish and Heimbecker. They have one at Cargill and Manitoba Pool and Saskatoon. So your refuse that you had, you couldn't keep it on hand because you'd have no room for actual grain, so you had to ship it somewhere to be pelletized, and we'd be shipped by, in those days, boxcars. And it's stuff just like feathers, all the way down, loaded into boxcars, trim it. You come out there looking like a ghost. So that was your job, that you did.
Any safety precautions in those days when you started?
You had a mask, that's it. Goggles. That was prior to all the systems they had now to suck all the air out. They just had what they call cyclones. That's just a little bit, but then everything got updated after that explosion in Vancouver. That changed everything.
Tell us a little bit about that explosion.
I was not in Vancouver, but there was a, I'm not sure. Well, federal government safety inspectors here have a film of it. They showed it to all of us. It's about an hour long, and it starts out with how it happened. And it was narrated by someone on CTV, I do believe, because they brought it to the all the elevators in lunchroom. We had the time off, and they showed, you know, how this came about for safety reasons, you know. And I'm sure it was the, it's federal government safety guys. I'm not sure if they still, they must be still here somewhere. I know what happened to the film. But it was quite an interesting film to watch how that could happen.
And do you recall which elevator was involved?
God. I'm going to say the Pacific elevator, but I'm not sure. I think, I'm not really sure if it is or not. But what happened was they were loading on a Russian saltwater ship, and it was some type of pellets. And they tend to do stick, and it was in the legs, and they had someone on the top of the floor, and the legs started to plug. And there was safety precaution. They had, all he had to do was shut it off. He didn't. They kept on going, and the friction started, and it blew the top of the elevator off. I forget how many it killed. And I still remember the one part at the top of the elevator was 7 or 8 blocks away. It blew that hard. Brand pellets they were. And all the guy had to do was slip, hit a switch, it would have stopped everything, and fine, he didn't. He died, so no one knows whatever happened, why he didn't. That was, what is he supposed to do? He just didn't. But yeah, I think that, yeah, I'm sure that that's who it was. The safety guys that do the safety for the elevators, I'm sure they brought the film down. And it's quite an interesting thing to watch. I think it's about an hour long. It goes through all the precautions of what happened and what they didn't do, what they were supposed to do. So if you got a hold of that, you get some interesting stuff out of that.
What were politics like in the elevator when you started?
I'm not sure if there's any politics at all. Really?
No cliques or?
No, I don't think so. In the bigger places, like the P&H elevator at one time, you had 20 people, and when it got really busy, I think got up to 45 with 3 shifts, but I don't really recall of any like that, no. Not really, no. You know, you get lots of times on payday, if we had no work the next day, we'd all go to the labor center and have down a few beers together, and that would be the whole gang. Even the foreman would come with us, you know, that's when we were unwashed, but you know, there was nothing that I could recall that something like that. No.
Anything that sticks in your memory about your time as a laborer, other than coming out looking as like a ghost?
No.
It was pretty routine.
Yeah. Oh yes. You did it all. That's how you learned the job.
That was roundabout then. They were introducing the sort of tank cars, but
hopper cars,
box cars,
yeah.
So would you be unloading a box car?
Oh, they had augers to unload that. They run in, took the grain out on both sides, and it was very common to break down about 20 times a shift. A terrible situation, but that's what they had, and then took them out and used just hopper cars, and that's fine, because you had no problem then. The grain would run down, it's your hopper, and all you had to do is open it. But the box car thing was terrible. Nobody wanted them. You know, it was so hard to unload, you had doors to open and so forth and so on, and sometimes you couldn't open them, sometimes they'd break, the whole thing would go all over the tracks. So it was something that, old, and nobody wanted them anymore.
I have a particular interest, because I'm that way, about boxcar doors.
What about them?
What about boxcar doors?
What?
You know, who used them? Where they tossed
out. Oh, the grain doors, you mean?
The grain doors, yeah.
Well, if you take a drive from, Central Avenue, look to your left going to Port Arthur, or go in, and you'll see all the houses are built with grain doors. Really, they took them all home. Well, they had no money. Their sheds, everything, grain doors. That's what they did with them. They might be torn down now, but that's basically that part of, what do you call it, the south end, that what it is? First Avenue, Second Avenue, mm-hmm. the houses inside there, they're mostly all
Ontario,
green.
Ontario, I think. Ontario.
Whatever. No, maybe not up that far.
Okay.
That's what they did with them. Because they were good wood.
Was that problematic for the elevator, or that they were glad to have one less thing to
get
rid
of?
I'm not
sure. That's way before my time, something like that. Yeah. I don't. Because it came, they used cardboard sheets after that, didn't use wood. So
after the laborer stint,
well,
how did your career unfold?
Funny thing happened when I was a laborer there. It was an old acquaintance of mine by the name of Frank Mazur. Asked me, would I like to come and be shop steward? Thought to myself, oh, here we go again. I said, oh, well, I'll try it. So here I go into that thing again, belong to the trades and labor councils and this kind of councils and that kind of grievance kind of, oh boy, oh boy. So anyways, I did that for about maybe, I think it was 12 months, and then I got offered a job as general foreman there. I took it. That was the end of my union stuff. So.
Was it difficult to move from...
No, no.
From union to management?
No, no. Not for me, it wasn't, no. You had a relationship with all the guys anyway, so you just, you know, you had a job to do, you had to do it. That's all. What's the big deal here? Only thing in the summer, well, when you were really busy 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, the money was great. But a lot of them would think of all these illnesses they had on long weekends, and that was kind of tough to fill in for them and whatever, but you tried your best. And then you understood that, you know, people do want time off, but there wasn't any. You know, because when you started it in the spring, you know, you got maybe some relief around Christmas time, and then about January, first week of January, any of the grain that wasn't gone by vessel, you shipped by rail to Montreal and to Quebec City. But guy could be up top of his hop for about 10 minutes, come down, send another guy up, and you'd have to do it that way, because otherwise he'd freeze solid. It was that cold. I don't know what happened to the winters now, but it was deathly cold when I went to work. Why isn't that cold now? I don't have to work.
There's cold, and there's cold at the top of an elevator on Lake Superior.
It was just dreadful. You know, I did it myself, but then I felt sorry for the guys that, hey, come down every 10 minutes. Don't stay up that long. They had balaclavas, coats on, and everything. You couldn't be steam coming off them and just froze to them. But that was it, and that was work, and that was the wintertime.
From foreman, you know, we're not all that interested, unless you can remember, the years that you were in that job and then where you moved on to from there.
Well, in 78, I got the foreman's job, and then in 89.
Superintendents there during your time.
When I got there, Davy Phillips was, and in fact, I think he was born on the property, I was told. Thunder Bay Harbor, and it was an old house there, and that's where the family was raised, and I guess he got a job in the elevator, and he was, I don't know, a teenager or something like that, and he stayed there. So how many years he was there, I'm not really sure. He's still I think he's still alive, yeah. And he retired in 89, I took his place.
Okay. Still in Thunder Bay?
Is he still in Thunder
mm-hmm.
Bay? I think he is, yeah.
Okay.
I don't, so the anecdote was he was, I'm not really sure. There was an older house there anyway, so it
mm-hmm.
could have been. So he was born into the grain trade. Right on the property. And then I guess the bit of information that's in there when the city, I guess it was the city and the province, decided that taxes should be raised. We had to go to an appeal and $2 million per year. And the company, well, we all met together, and the company said, you know, there's about 150 jobs here. We get a tax relief because it would not generate that kind of income to keep everything going. The city said no, so they closed the elevator. That's it. The city was responsible for that. And behind us was Thunder Bay Harbor. They paid $5,000 a year taxes with a larger property. At Parrish and Heimberg, Gallagher, we were paying $650,000 for the smaller property. I couldn't figure that one out. Why? We went to Peel with all these different people, consultants and all that. We won, but it cost us more money than taxes would have been. So, whatever.
Over time, getting the reduction,
it took many years, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's dropped quite a bit now. Another anecdote, what I thought was really funny, was Thunder Bay Hydro. Not Thunder Bay Hydro, Terry Hydro, I think it was. Worked 12 to 8 in the wintertime, loading your cars. And I thought to myself, you know what? You come here at 11:30 tonight with me. I'll meet you here. I'll send you on top of the car and then let me know if it's a hell of a good idea. He never came back. Well, think about it, midnight? Oh, God. But.
So Davy Phillips was one of the superintendents that you
worked
under?
Yeah, he started out as a laborer, too.
Yeah? Yeah. And then?
And myself.
And then you, okay.
That was 89, and in 91, my boss retired, and I got the job as manager. Until 1999, I retired.
And your boss was?
Bill Parrish.
Oh,
out of Winnipeg, yeah. Out of Winnipeg, yeah. You mean when I was superintendent? The manager was Larry Carroll.
Okay, still, yeah.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
And then you went from superintendent to manager, so
yeah.
That's the...
Yeah.
So what years were you the manager?
91 to 99.
And you started in the green?
76.
76. So you were active through the real boom years.
Mm-hmm.
And also then?
Well, I think.
I
think the 1988 was a drought year. I can't think if that was the year or not, or 89 or something. It was a real bad year. There was nothing here. And I think it was 88. Now, another anecdote was maybe. The guys worked about maybe a month in the spring for shipping without a grain we had, and then it was a drought. They're all laid off, except for about management. And a lot of them were in financial difficulties. And I guess a couple, never said anything to me, but one or two of them phoned Winnipeg, said that their mortgages were due and they were going to get kicked out. And Bill Parrish phoned me. He said, hire them all back. I said, well, we got nothing to do. He said, hire everyone back, let them pick dandelions off the tracks. That kind of thing was, it was contract negotiating time. They went on strike that October, and he was kind of upset about that. I said, here, they came to work in July, did just pick dandelions, now they go on strike. Of course, they had no choice, I don't think, but still, he didn't feel very good about it. And him being quite a guy, I mean, I still admire him for that. What other company would do that? Paid for, there was no income for the elevator, but he paid it out.
Any other Bill Parrish stories
that
you can tell?
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I have a good one. When Pool 3 closed, and a guy named Jimmy Black took it over, I guess he was, I forget how that worked, but he had equipment for sale you could, you know, to sell that you might use, and P&H had quite a few elevators out west, I think in Medicine Hat and Moose John, places like that. And they could use some of the equipment. Pool 3, you know, we went up through, and we were on the roof, top of the elevator. He was looking for something up there, I can't remember what it was. There happened to be a seagull's nest. You know what they're like when there's a seagull's nest?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first they fly at you at your head to stop you. This one didn't. It crapped all over his suit, nice Italian silk suit. Well, I could. He said, you can go ahead and laugh. He said, I've been shit on by better people. So that's what he said. What are you going to do? It was head to foot, so I had to go back to the elevator to clean him off because he can't fly back like that. But, you know, he was that kind of a guy.
Yeah.
Nothing seemed to bother him, I don't know. He said, every dark cloud has silver lining, so.
Hmm.
his attitude that way.
You would probably appreciate listening to his interview, which we, you know, which he have, and he's released, so it's available if if you'd like to hear it.
Yeah. We had one of our ships, we owned some lake ships, I forget which one it was, it tied up overnight for some reason. As it pulled out, the dock collapsed, which was behind the elevator, not too behind where the dock. So the warehouse, everything went in, half the tracks. I come there in the morning, I couldn't believe it. So we thought maybe the dock towards the elevator would be, something would be wrong with it too, to make the thing collapse. And we had to call the engineering outfit and some divers to go and look to be sure, you know, and, you know, just in case it was a big problem there. And when Bill Parrish came down and to look to see what could be done about it, and the tenders put out by the engineering firms were that high, he said, I think that's the end of it. We have to close the place. It's just too much money to fix it. And lo and behold, I can't think of his name. Pierre Gagne, I think his name was. He did. The place is running. Because we were all looking for a job the day after, because he said, that's, you know, we're going to close. I mean, you know, you couldn't generate enough income to pay for that, what they wanted, what the construction companies wanted. Well, this guy did. Yeah, Pierre Gagne was the name. Small-time operator. I think he was from Geraldton originally or something like that. And he did it. Still there. Just as good as ever.
What exactly caused the problem?
Well, I think when they see... I'm not an engineer, but I found out after. The draft at the elevator, we couldn't finish it. You see, I think we had 21.9 feet there. So at the Boston, Winnipeg, or whoever was the one, why don't we dredge it so we can finish a ship, you know? So I think the seaway depth now, seaway depth is what, 25, 26, I forget now. Okay? So the we dredged it, okay? I built the dock there. They had big cables holding it on the other side of the tracks. The tracks went sort of on a slope, so the cars would run. And I guess they rotted, and the strain of the pressure, the cables broke, and the dock went over. I kind of thought, oh, geez, it must be our fault. What would we do wrong? Then I found out. Did nothing wrong. Somebody in the engineering department of Winnipeg decided to do that, and that's what killed it. You can never, you know, just like having something you dug underneath, it's going to tip. And that's what happened.
Anything surprise you about the job as the head guy in Thunder Bay? Any surprises? Pleasant, unpleasant?
No, if you're a politician or try to be, when you have equipment, ongoing things got to be repaired. And I said, why do you want Cadillac equipment for a Volkswagen elevator? That was his song. Well, I said, you know, if you don't fix things, they break down, and then you're going to have nothing to work with. And, you know, when you have something done, it's not a couple of dollars, it's thousands of dollars. You know, nothing is cheap. You know, first year I was there, I think I spent $1.5 million. You know, that sounds like paltry, but, you know, to them it was quite a bit, but you have to fix things, you know. So that was a part usually with those type of things. We'd always have sort of a titty on the telephone all the time. But I got it. I got my way. Well, for instance, if things were loading ships, if you held up a ship for demurrage, it's $25,000 a day, okay? It's a bit of money. So I told him, I said, okay, we'll leave it at that. It'll take about a week to fix those scales, so that's about 7 times 25. I got it done right away that day. Fix it. I was lying a bit. But you had to. Things go, and... you know, cleaners, that type of thing. If you had a different type of grain, you know, you had to have those things done. Because, you know, you got a small turnover in a small elevator, you know, you had to put it through as fast as you can.
got a couple of questions here, and then I'd sort of like to take a break, give you a chance to stretch your legs and so on for 5 minutes or so. You've talked a lot about your career, and you've probably already answered this in a different form, but the question reads, what might interest or surprise people most about the work you did?
I don't think I have an answer for that. Maybe you don't. I don't know.
Okay. That's not an unusual answer to that question. What are you most... Take a while to think about it. There's
no
hurry.
I'm not really sure. What the heck would I be... My relationship with the employees, I would think, and I guess with the owners and that type of thing, I guess. I just can't think of anything that, you know. And the relationship with the other terminal elevators, with the managers there, you know, with any problems that we would have amongst each other with loading grain, we're quite up to it that we'd help each other out, you know, those type of things. And
mm-hmm. What kind of problems occur in that?
Well, a lot of times
requires that cooperation.
A lot of times when you load grain, there's a tolerance for it, okay? And mistakes are made sometimes, and you're over your tolerance. For instance, you're shipping a 1 red 13.5 and their level. And if another elevator can put enough on to sort of bring the standard up to it, well, you know, you'd call them and say, can you help me? You know, and basically, yeah, sure.
Was it always a cooperative relationship?
I found it was.
Company to another?
I did, yeah. Well, you're competing with each other. But that type of situation, everyone has them. So you never say no. You know, you have them.
Because it might be you next week if you say no this week.
That's true. That could happen to anyone. So that type of thing, you just a phone call and be fine. You know. And then you get to with the grain inspection up here. The people that were in charge then were pretty darn good about it too. You know, they didn't really penalize you. If unless you really extremely did, you know, flaunted them. But they tried to help you out too. Because most of the old staff of the grain inspectors said, we work for the elevator companies, they don't work for us. That was lost on the younger people. You know, because without a grain trade, they wouldn't have a job.
Things we'll come back to after we take a short break.
Yeah.
The next question on the list is sort of a more general philosophical question. It's how do you feel that the work you did in the grain trade contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader?
I'll answer that one. How would I answer that? Productivity or whatnot. I'm not really sure how to answer something like that. Just part of a small spoke in the wheel with productivity and maintaining the throughput of grain to Thunder Bay.
And how does that
filter down of all the salary or the wages of the people that work there, you know, it's contributed to.
Makes it a viable industry.
Yeah, yeah.
And what about on the other side, the customer side?
I never had any dealings with them.
No?
No. Only ones I would have dealings with would be the U.S. ones. If we ship something to the U.S., if they had any complaints, you dealt with them directly. But as far as going overseas, nothing whatsoever mm-hmm. that I've never had. No.
Did you know who you were shipping to?
No. I'm just trying to recall. We have salties in there loading types of grain. I'm not really sure where it was going. I can't really recall. No, I'm not really sure. Had a destination on it. We'd have orders for the grain, but I'm not sure if they had a destination
mm-hmm.
or not.
Because mm-hmm.
they would go to different elevators, and so you had your share or whatever you put on, whatever you had. But I'm not aware of.
Connections that way, or?
Well, yeah, because Parrish and Heinenberger had country elevators, and you got their grain from them, but the producers, well, there was apparently there's a bit of a misunderstanding with producers. They would seem to think they're sending you top grain. No. And we'd always say, look, at you know, if you're not going to fool anybody up here. We have grain inspection. We have ourselves. Like, what are you trying to tell us? They complained to the people in Winnipeg, and the people in Winnipeg would call us. It is what it is. We can't change it. We've got no magic wand here. However, which is one of the things the trade always did. If Bill Parrish always had a poor farmer with 10 children and his cow was dying, would you take his grain? It's not really a good thing, a grain, but could you blend it and make sure he gets top dollar for it? And we unload the cars and we phone up Bill. I said, Bill, I don't know about that poor farmer, but I'm telling you what he sent us is awful. But we get rid of it. And so he'd have maybe a 3 red, which is bottom or utility. He'd want a price of a 1 red for it, which is quite a bit of an upgrade, but we did that. And it's called blending, and we tried our best. We did that. But that's when the anecdote goes, Bill and this poor farmer with the 10 children, he's going to be thrown off his property, and he sent us these cars. Oh, God. It was laughable. Joking the trade, everyone knew about him just doing that. But being the man he is, you'd always try for him.
Was blending ever not successful, or did you have... It seems to me that is...
It's illegal. The Grain Commission doesn't allow that.
Tell us more about that.
Well, for instance, if you have... say, 2,000 tons of 2 red grain came down here. The producer sent it as a 1 red, okay? If you had maybe 10,000 tons of 1 red, you'd run it together to make the grade. It was one of those things that you weren't supposed to do, but everyone, it was an acceptable situation, you did it. Because the Grain Commission, too, understands they're looking after farmers' interests, too, also, you know, not in the sense ours. It was something we did.
I have a question of how did that car get to you listed as number one when at the primary elevators it has to be graded?
Poor grading there. No, everything's a number one to them. Well, when they unloaded it, it come by truck, okay? So to catch a sample, whatever it was, and maybe the farmer is pretty smart. He makes sure the good part comes out first, and the rest of the garbage comes behind it. And that's, you know, they have a bag, and they send it in. Okay, that's 1 red. The rest of it isn't. So I suppose they did it that way. I never spent much time out that way. So
I guess that's how they designed the system when they sampled cars, that the scoops went down through the whole car so that you couldn't...
Yeah, you got it all, yeah. It came off the belt, you know, and then you got the whole car, and you got your samplers, and then you had sort of a... But that kind of system was beaten by a few people way back then, too.
What they do, they
put in more dockage than there was. They have the guys stand on the belt and throw more dockage in. That way the elevator would get more money.
Don't understand that.
Well, you got to clean the dockage out of it.
So they could claim then that it was...
Yeah.
So who makes those decisions?
Well, those days with the elevators, they all did, I guess. I'm not sure what they did. Where we were at our place, you couldn't do it. It was too small for a place. But they did, I guess. Yeah, so.
Interesting.
It is.
Any other interesting stories you have?
Well, when they had weigh-overs, I've never seen it, but they used to have, if it was in the summertime, we get somebody's high school son that was to sit on the bar of the scale, the old scales, to make more weight. That way the audit would be okay. There's bars in there, and when you weighed the grain, it would show something, but it really wasn't. But I've never seen it either. It was one of those anecdotes you heard passed on and on. So
digital scales? Did you do a rig with that? Old
hand ones.
Yeah, so digital scales might have dealt with that.
Yeah, they could. They could. They can be fooled with, too. Oh, yeah.
Canadian Grain Commission, how does that, How did that feature into your career?
Pretty well, quite a bit. I learned a lot from them, the people that were in the trade. You know, they were pretty helpful because I, you know, if you're walking off the street, you know, and you haven't been in the grain trade like some people are, had nepotism was predominant in the harbor here. I mean, father, son, all, you know, grandfather, they all worked in the trade, so they knew it. But they were pretty good. I had a good relationship with them, all of them. You know, it's with the higher, even the grain inspector, I found them very helpful. They were a few oddballs that, you know, they were sent somewhere else into purgatory because they couldn't get along with anybody. But otherwise, it was darn good.
What kinds of things would you do that would indicate you couldn't get along with people?
Well, a lot of them just didn't know how to grade grain. So they made everything one thing, and you'd be stuck with all this stuff. You'd have to bring it up here and say, no, they do whatever. And they do it. So they re-inspect all the cars, and, you know, it was more work for them up here, but that's what they did.
So incompetence, in other words, shows its head in every
organization. Well, what happened was, you know, like I said, nepotism was predominant here, and they hired people. When things were busy, I mean, you know, a lot of people were afraid to walk down the street, then we get hired. Well, there was a lot of work everywhere. And I guess they just hired people they shouldn't have hired, and it happens to everybody, I guess, you know. So they were grain inspectors and whatever you call them. And so it's...
What was the relationship like between the grain inspectors and samplers that were through the Grain Commission and the Parrish and Heinbeckers? Did you have your own on staff?
And grain inspection, no, never had any. We did our own. Tried our best, did our own, but then we, you know, the grain inspector was helpful in case, you know, something you were stuck with, and then people down here were, you know, they re-inspect the cars to make sure everything was fine, you know, it would happen. And, mm-hmm. and then with re-inspection, there was always someone up here, how that worked, I'm not really sure, but if a producer thought he was getting a bad deal on a certain car, he'd call the grain inspection here, and they would re-inspect the car, but he'd have to pay whatever, I'm not sure how much it is, but, you know, to make sure we weren't doing it to him. Because they always felt that we were always cheating him, you know, out of his rightful grade of grain, but the grain inspection here would sort of be in between and say, yeah, they're right, so...
Mm-hmm. That relationship has been around for a long time, the farmer-producer versus the, mm.
oh,
the grain
yeah.
company.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Since
yeah.
the trade began, from mm-hmm. my reading of the history books.
Well, the chairman of P&H, Mr. Heinbecker, he was the eastern part of the company, and he always called us crooks.
With a smile on his face, no doubt.
Oh, I don't know if he had a smile. He phoned me a few times. You're cheating me again. I said, not me.
How does that work? Like,
well,
within the same
instance,
company,
does
this occur?
Well, for instance, there's a P&H owned the Onsand elevator, and they had parts in Godrich elevator, and what else did they have? And certain grains were shipped, and, you know, they passed inspection, like, you know, and I guess when they unload them or, you know, say, for instance, oats for the horses, what all that, and you say, there's too much of that, too much of this in it. And I said, hey, certificate, once it's a certificate, it is what it is, you know. But he calls crooks anyways. He cheated me again. So I had the pleasure of going to annual meetings with him. Really strange. You'd have a few cocktails at every sit, be seated. And if you were a lash, you'd sit next to him. Oh, boy.
What was he like? His name comes up very often.
Grumpy as hell, but a hell of a nice guy. Hell of a nice guy.
So was he actually stationed, not in Winnipeg then?
He was in Toronto.
Oh.
Yeah. And they're pretty big in the flour trade. And I guess whatever. I think
Butterball turkeys.
Oh, yeah, they're into that too. Canadian, oh, yeah, they got that. And, you know, they're... They're not small as ever things, you know, and they got a few elevators out there, and I think around Sarnia and some places like that. They look after that, but he passed away, I think, the year after I retired. The strangest thing with that company that I noticed, that when I mentioned that I wanted to retire, my wife was ill, and they asked me how old I was, and they all looked at me like I was crazy. I said, well, what's wrong? Well, most of the people that are working there, they're in their 70s and 80s, they die in the chair. So I said, what do you want to retire for? Take some time off. You know, they just stay till they die. They don't quit. They don't retire. So, but nice people.
Good place to work.
Well, it is. It is. It's a very fine company. I think it's very good.
Changes over the years within the industry.
Changes. Everything's automated. Everything.
What kind of impact did that have on you?
Less
personally?
People. Less people. That's what happened. Less people. Not too much grunt work. You know, you have to, you know, clean and sweep the elevator and all that. But then you, with everything automated, you don't need nothing. Scales are automated. You got automatic samplers. What else would you need?
Is this a good thing?
Yeah, for the company, I guess it is. Yeah, not for the people who work. But I mean, it's a common thing. I mean, what are you going to do? That's everything's automated now. I mean, it's, you don't do anything by hand. You have everything's documented. You know.
Did it have a personal impact on you in the work that you had to do? I'm assuming that you would have had to be part of the downsizing.
Not really. Well, yeah, it's, in a sense, we had quite a few management staff, and for the size of the working staff, so I had to let a couple of foremen go. I didn't like that, but what can I do? It's one of those things. You had to choose. It's a pretty difficult thing to do with someone's life, but you got to do it.
How do you choose?
Well, by age, I guess. A person pretty close to us, you know, to getting pension time, and what the company would do is top it up to put him his time that he could receive his pension at 60. You know, so if he went elsewhere, you know, he'd have that to look forward to, and, you know, at that time he wouldn't lose anything by that, you know. So that's why that, I think, Parrish Steinbeck was good that way. You know, that they're getting a little too old to do, you know, some heavy work to be done, and they're getting a little too old for it, so you buy them out, give them their pension, and goodbye. Have a little party for them. Good to see you. Give them their turkey and ham every Christmas while they're alive. That's it.
Still do that, the turkey and ham?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Everyone gets it. It's one of the traditions started by Bill Parrish. I know another anecdote about Bill Parrish. Way back when the harbor was really going like full tilt, a lot of the employees of different companies got jackets with, you know, their logo on them, you know, nice jackets. We didn't have any. Anyhow, we came down to visit, and he wanted to talk to all the gang in the lunchroom and all that. And he said, write out something for me, I can say, in case I forget. The end of the statement said, I'm happy to announce that you're all going to get jackets. He left the room. He said, you got it. You finally caught. We got them.
So he'd read it out before he knew what he was getting.
That's right. I put it at the end. It was a good sport.
The changes in technology that occurred over the time, were they seamlessly implemented, or from what you recall?
Pretty well, yeah. With the new scales and new technology with samplers and all that, they broke down and no one knew what the hell to do. And the people putting it in were, I think, actually didn't know whether they're doing it. And it took a lot of time that you lost a lot of time unloading and loading ships because of that. But now they got down to science where they can, when they program something, they have an idea where it is. Then you didn't. You had to go through the whole system again and reboot everything and this, that, and you sit and tear your hair. But now they can find out everything.
Change over to metric occurred before you got in there?
Just when I got there. It was bushels. Don't ask me how much bushels. I don't even know. Just got there. And they, how many bushels it is, I'm not really know to a ton. I don't know why we went metric for in North America.
Actually, you might be interested in the tape that was made by the guy who headed up the metric conversion for the Canadian Grain Commission.
Who's that?
Do you remember the name, Ian? In Winnipeg. He was the head of the Weights and Measures. And the and also Frank Rowan. I don't know if you came across him in your career.
No.
He was with the Canadian Wheat Board. And the amount of paperwork that going metric took out of the system was phenomenal.
Right?
I was really surprised. So if you're interested someday, I'll pull out that. Speaking of that, what was your relationship with the Wheat Board? Did you have anything to do with it locally, or was that handled in Winnipeg?
Yes, we did. There was a liaison with the Wheat Board. He'd come down here maybe 2-3 times a year. And we had the grain processing meeting jeeps. And basically, he tried to hit here before the crop year to give us an indication of what the fall is going to be like. So that was pretty good. And then, they came in the fall, too, late fall, too, and let us know how the winter is going to be and whatever we're going to have this spring. So, but that's the only thing that I had with him.
No hassles occurred that
not that I can
be
think
smoothed
of
out?
No, it was the Winnipeg people looked after that. I didn't bother.
And this is coming, sort of coming back to the beginning of your career, because another side of it is your involvement with the shipping, from the perspective of being a manager, and now you're dealing with the ships that come in. Tell us a bit about what a manager does in relation to the ships.
Well, you get your orders to load. You know what you're going to put on, and the only difficulty that we had here in the harbor, and it wasn't just us, was a ship safe at noon. The agent for the ship said, well, I'm not paying the overtime. I said, we're not. It's like on a Sunday or a holiday, it's triple time. We're not going to eat that. So those are disputes we had, and all the companies would say, well, that's fine, they let the ship sit till the next day. And that would get them furious. Well, they don't want to do that either. But few of them were like that, and some of them understood. We're not there, we're not there. But like I say, don't you have telephones or fax machines to let us know that you're going to be late? I mean, technology on the ships, they got everything. Didn't bother, so they had to pay. But then again, Parrish and Heimer had lake ships, and I'd send the bill in with our overtime and all our wages for loading the ship into Winnipeg, and find out that they didn't charge them anyway. And then when I got my quarterly statement, profit and loss, I used to notice that all the time. Yeah, bottom line's your bottom line.
Yeah, there's no little asterisk saying, oh, by the way, we know that.
Yeah, that's right.
Shifting the liability between elements of the system.
Yeah.
Did ships ever bash into you, or... You had a good safety record from the...
Oh, sure.
But...
Well, with the capstan, some that you put the lines on, a couple of ships come in, ripped them right off, took the concrete and everything out, and then denied it. Like, we could see it sitting on the deck. And then one of the saltwater boats come in, and we told the agent they had to pump water. And usually you put something on so it'll go straight down. Being a foreign ship, I forget the agent was there, Billy Harib. I said, hey, look, the ship is pretty high. I'm going to pump water. You make sure it goes down into the slip, not on our dock. He didn't listen either. Filled our electrical room, cut the power out. I said, no, do everything. Our powerhouse shut down. So those things do happen. But an agent here that's supposed to look after things like that. But otherwise, other than that, a few of the ships, it gets windy, we'll bounce off your dock, but tear a piece off, but we fix it and send him the bill.
It was Bill Harib? Was that the name
mentioned? Bill Harib was an agent for most of them, I believe. I'm not sure if there was a few other ones, but I'm not sure how many there's left here. We knew them all. They'd call you and let you know when the ship's coming in, and then, of course, they had to be pre-inspected to make sure the cargo holds are clean, no bugs and all that, whatever. And they always do that at anchor. They used to do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Entomology did all that.
We interviewed Victor Bell.
Victor Bell, yeah. He used to do all that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He has, his interview was very interesting as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, a lot of the ships that come in was pretty darn dirty, you know. You know, because we got accused of loading a ship with bugs in it, and I don't know what happened, or he missed it, but in the top of the... There they wanted us to pay, but we're not going to pay because, you know, it's infested, not our problem. Mm. But it was, yeah.
When you're talking about infestation, and we're sort of on the topic of changes here, how were infestations dealt with in the industry?
Malathion we used. Malathion, and with the bins, I forget what kind of, we'd close off the bins and seal them off, and if the bin was, I forget what product we used. We tried to train our own people, but it got to be a hassle, so we just called another firm and they did it, you know. Taped everything off to make sure that, you know, it wouldn't get into the, you know, the elevator, so all that, and malathion was sprayed on the perimeters for mites or something like that, you'd get in there. Same thing with pest control with rats and mice, you'd call a private firm in and, you know.
How do you ensure the safety of the product?
Like malathion? Well, malathion.
I lived in Winnipeg for 30 years.
You know, the spray all the...
Yeah.
After dark?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do it in a grain elevator, you have to have just something like a space suit on. You know, you have just to protect yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You could get ill from it, you did in the elevator, everything was sealed off and you could still operate. You know?
Mm-hmm. And what about residue in the product?
Well, from what I gather, I forget how many days you have to, it's been there 5-6 days a week, whatever it is, and it would all disappear anyway, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, and what you would do when the period of time that, you know, you'd have a date on the bottom of the bin so you couldn't open it and be sealed off, and then you have a date, then you turn over the grain and send a sample here to entomology to make sure it's fine, you know, before you ship it anywhere.
Mm. Ian, did you have some questions that you wanted to, you were sort of leaning forward there, so I don't know if there was...
Just jumping back, what does this...
Well, he's supposed to allot all the work for everybody in the elevator, including the foreman, you know, the cleaning the grain, cleaning the elevator. That's what he's supposed to do. And the managers make sure that he does that. Well, that's what he does, yeah.
Plus, the manager then is also responsible for the liaison with head office,
yeah,
which the superintendent wouldn't be.
All the expenditures, all that stuff, yeah. Payroll, but I mean, you just sign the payroll anyway. That's, you can't change that much. It's what you get is what you get.
Mm. Labor relations stay pretty much steady over your time, or were there changes?
Well, with
there?
Frank Mazur, it was fine. You always had these things before negotiation. You throw all these darts, and you're going to do this and all that.
Theater?
Theater, yeah. I mean, you have to do all that stuff, and what part of no don't you understand, and those kind of things. You have to go through all that stuff, and it'd be a bloody joke. So, the only one that we had was, he was sort of a funny person. I don't know. One day everything was fine, the next day it wasn't, and he couldn't make up his mind. And you know, he'd have some severe consequences. I mean, there's a chap that was told, look, you come to work drunk, you're fired. I mean, we went bent over backwards with the guy. He came to work. He wasn't even supposed to be, he was on vacation. Come to work drunk. Finally, I said, enough's enough, we fired him. Well, the union rep, it agreed. 6 months later, he wants to go to arbitration. We went through arbitration. I think it cost us about $10,000. The guy came back to work. I said, well, here's what is going to happen. You lose all your seniority. The next time you have a come to work drunk, that's it, you're done. I'm happy to say that he joined Smith Clinic, and he's a counselor there, hasn't had a drink since.
So a second chance worked, or...
It did for him.
You know, in listening to the interviews, drinking really did seem to be an issue.
It was, yes.
And give us your thoughts on, like, why was it in that industry, or was it in all industries?
I have no idea.
How was it tolerated?
The only time that I know that people would have a drink would be Christmas. You'd shut down, say, noon on the 24th. We get some food in, took a couple cases of beer, everybody have something to eat, go home. That's about at P&H anyway. But other places, I guess, they might have extended or some darn thing. I don't know, a bigger place might have, but that was it. That was the end of it. But as far as bringing liquor into the elevator, I don't think that I've ever seen anybody, my time there, like drinking on the job, brought something there to drink. I don't think I've ever seen it. Not there. They might come to work in the morning with a bit of last night's in them, but I mean, nothing like that, no. They have a pop cooler, the old ones. They have a keg of beer in it. That was way before my time. Mm. I just wonder how they did it. But that was the way system in those days, I guess.
Hmm. Safety in the elevator.
Well, you tried to do the best you can with safety. You sort of, like, I belonged to the safety committee, and I was chairman of the IAPA here and whatever. And the thing is, if the employees don't care about it, there's nothing you're ever going to do for them. You know, you try to explain to them of everything. I'll give you an example. Say, for instance, you have an entranceway right behind you. Someone drops a shovel there, doesn't pick it up. But if he trips over it, you're at fault. That's to drive me insane. I go around picking stuff up because of that. And I say to them, I said, I hate to see what your home is like if that's the way you do things here. You know, some of them pick up on it and they change. You know, it's got to take an accident for them to realize. And unfortunately, we didn't have anything that bad there, you know. But prior to me being there, a guy got his legs cut off, fell off a boxcar, so.
He fell off?
He didn't have a safety belt hooked on. He just fell underneath it and cut his legs off.
Oh.
That was prior to my time, anyway. I was told that. Other than that, you tried your best with it, you know. Then you had the federal government, the safety guys would come down, and, you know, you'd have everything to a T, everything that's supposed to be under regulations. And the only citation you got, the garbage can cover wasn't on. I grit my teeth. Can you believe this?
Changes in the overall industry during your time, and even comments that you might have on recent changes, if you sort of keep up with what's going on.
Just the automation is all I can think of, really. That's all I can really think of, you know.
Well, in Thunder Bay, there certainly was a big change in.
Oh, yeah. The change in the industry altogether?
Yeah.
The downturn is here. And if they got rid of Churchill, that might help. But the federal government keeps funding that place, and I don't know what for. They only operate 3 or 4 months a year, and apparently from the people that go up there, it's quite a mess.
Mess in what way?
Well, the place is just, well, I guess when you go in the spring, one guy told me, well, they have the windows up there, they're all busted, it's full of pigeons, all the droppings are in there, they got to be cleaned up, and you got grain, you're supposed to be going somewhere. Like, do they do it? I don't know, I've never seen the place, but, and the tracks going up is all muskeg, so the grain might arrive or might not arrive or whatever. I'm not really sure. I think it would be positive, but I'm sure Bill Parrish told you that. He just hates that place. He doesn't think that it's proper for the federal government to spend money there and not send nothing here to, you know, for this harbor, which I agree. A lot of things can be done here. But
what would you, if you had the magic wand and could make things happen that you wanted to happen, what would you like to see happen? Besides the Churchill situation?
Well, it would be very costly. You'd have to make the seaway big enough for the saltwater ships to come directly here to heck with Montreal and Quebec City. Then you'd have a good trade. Mm. But otherwise than that, I guess to dredge the harbor to make sure that you can load the ships to whatever depth they are. That's about it, I guess.
Was Parrish and Heimbecker fairly fortunate with where they're located as far as depth of the slip, or were...
No, it was only the smaller one because the smaller ships used to come in there. That's why they had their own ships for quite a while. It didn't matter. And when the you couldn't finish boats and you lost so much cargo, you couldn't load a boat to certain depth. So that's when the dredge in the dock fell down. So that's the end of that tune. So, well, the changes I can't comment on them. Just the automation, I guess, and that's about it, I guess. I don't know. It's only other thing that I'm hearing quite often now is the wheat board is playing games with the elevator companies here. They got that mission terminal up there, and they're undercutting all the guys, all the elevators here, and I don't know how they're doing it. Unless some kind of a kickback, because the grain is supposed to be spread around to everyone, but it's not. They're getting all the work, and the other guys here are laid off. But that's another thing.
What would you say was the major challenge of your career, or challenges if you have?
Staying alive, I guess. I don't know. I don't have an idea.
Well, from the early stories, I can see where that's very true.
I really don't know. I can't tell you.
So if you look at your time as manager, then let's keep to that. What was the major challenge? If there was one.
Well, the major challenge was back then, you're allotted so many percentage-wise of grain coming into the harbor, And the terminal we had was much too small to unload it all. So we were always behind. And we owned lake ships. And I always bug Bill Perry, says, put the lake ships in here. So it's a moneymaker. I mean, if we can unload all these cars, do all this grain, it'll double your profit. But the lake shippers sort of had a hint on that. They say that you're only allotted so much for your percentage. If you had one ship for 25,000, you had to wait till that or whatever. And that was the challenge to do that. Now, apparently, with the mission terminal in there, they get all the ships they want, and no one seems to worry about it. Mm.
So the lake shippers is trying to balance, or at least...
Well, yeah,
you
balance your percentage.
Balance,
yeah. Yeah, your percentage, yeah. But, then when all the grain was coming, it was coming out of your ears. I mean, you tried to. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest challenge to do it. I mean, your small capacity just killed you if you didn't get a boat every third day. That way you could do it. And there was a lot of lake ships in those days. A lot of them. But that was the challenge.
One area we didn't talk about makes me think of it, because we're talking about the challenge of getting things out, but then stuff is coming in. So we didn't talk about your interaction with the railways.
Canadian Pacific was super. CNR was certainly not responsible, that's what we call him. He was just horrid. I would, any contract that was sent out by the Winnipeg people for grain coming down here, don't use CNR. We just didn't want it. It just was awful. And
how can, what describes awful in comparison?
Well, I'll give you some examples. For instance, some grain would be in the fall chartered to ocean ships, okay? So, for instance, there's 20,000 tons of barley going on a certain ship on, say, November the 5th. CNR is going to bring them, you have to give us about maybe 2 weeks leeway to unload it. Well, the ship is here and the grain's still there. Who's paying the demurrage? The railroad or the elevator company? There'd be a big fight over that. It's not here. With CPR, if it isn't coming, at least they tell you, hey, we got a problem, derailment, so forth, so CNR, nothing. I know we have annual weekly grain meetings with all the managers. Every week we'd have one, every Thursday morning.
The elevator managers.
Yeah, we'd meet, with what we're doing, what shifts going on, whatever. And Bob McKinnon from there, with all of us there, phoned the president of CN. We still haven't got a call back yet. That was in 1992. Don't seem to care. The whole harbor was just stuck with, and Sask Wheat Pool then was CN House. We were CP, thank God. But some of the cargoes were shipped with CN. They had to bring that grain down.
How do you get to be one house or another?
I think they signed contracts. I mean, it goes back way back to whatever it is. But the thing is, if you don't unload cars, you're charged a demurrage, okay? A daily demurrage. But if the railroad doesn't bring them, tough luck. And I always ask that question. I said, when you sign contracts, they're sort of a five-year period or somewhat of a sign. Why don't you put that in there? Oh, we have such good relationship with the railroads, we don't want to do that. And I said, when you get demurrage things for, you know, for things you can't unload and not hear, and don't you complain to somebody? Yeah, we call you. There you go. That was my answer. Why haven't you unloaded? Well, I said, I can't. We can't stretch out to Moose Jaw from here. Our pipes aren't long enough. Other than that, that was it with CN. I don't know what they do now, but or how they work it, but that was always a... They still make money, I suppose. I don't know.
What do you think of elevators?
What do I think of
them? Do you think of them fondly? Do you think of them...
What a question that is. I don't know. What do I think of them? Looking at them, you mean, or what?
Well, whatever. How they feel to you, just...
Well, I guess in a sense I miss it. Mm-hmm. You know, working there, yeah, but otherwise I don't know what I would say about them. I'm so used to them, you know, you spend half your life here, you always see them, so what? Sad to see them go down, you know, you don't want to see that, but apparently it has to happen.
Were you here when Pool 6 was... demolished?
Yes, oh yes.
What were you doing that day?
Not sure. I can't recall.
You weren't watching?
I don't think so. I'm not really sure. You know the date of it? When it went down, by any chance?
Was it in 1999?
No, I'm talking about
2000? No, or be early 2000s. I think it was before we moved back here.
No,
they had the big explosion, and there were some people toasting it with champagne glasses,
no,
and there were other, others
where I was in town or not,
crying over it.
Yeah, no, I can't recall. Yeah. Nope. Other than that.
Any questions along that line before I ask the sort of last question?
Yeah, as you know, Nancy and a bunch of other folks are trying to rehabilitate an elevator or make it into something that the public can go to. Just off the top of your head, what's the best candidate?
With the ones left empty here?
Yeah.
How much space would you want?
Well, that's a whole question in itself, but...
probably, just to say a little bit more about what Ian's asking, we had a consultant's report done on the feasibility of having a national grain industry, international grain industry historic and activity center. And their recommendation was you don't want to get an elevator because the cost, as you well know, of maintaining that, even if it's not functioning, is horrendous. But featuring an elevator so that looking for something that has an attractive surrounding that you could actually bring people in and around the elevator and perhaps isolate maybe part of the workhouse.
Well, I'm not sure how the structure is of that old pool, too. You know where it is by the marina.
Yes, indeed.
That would be an ideal one, wouldn't it? Close to the marina like that, wouldn't it?
I would say so. It's a beautiful historic building.
It's one of the oldest, I think.
Yeah.
But who owns it, I'm not sure.
Buchanan.
What does he? Mm-hmm. Oh, he's a nice man, isn't he? Does he own that? Mm-hmm. Of course, he said no. Huh?
He also owns Pool 3, I understand.
Oh, he bought that, did he? From what happened to Jimmy Black? Did he die then?
He sold it to him.
Oh, did he? Mm-hmm. Well, wow. I haven't seen Jimmy in a few years, so I didn't know what he was doing. Okay, so that would be the ideal thing, I think. It's small. Did they mention to you that Canada Malting elevator in Toronto, you know what happened to it?
Hmm.
It's condos.
Yeah.
The elevator. round condos. I haven't seen it. I haven't been to Toronto for a few years, but that's what they did with it. Some architect did that. It's on the waterfront. It was, I think it was the size of a P&H elevator. I mean, it wasn't that big.
Yeah.
But that's what it is. So, but with this place, it has a lot of renovating to do. Oh boy.
Pool four.
It's too big. You don't want something that size.
Beautiful location. Nice big surrounding.
What about the place across from Pool 7? What's happened there, do you know? I think the what the word was...
UGG.
Well, yeah, I think Dawson owns the Tugs here. I think he bought that property. I mean, maybe he didn't.
Port Authority.
Oh, Port Authority got it? Why would they let... otherwise, I don't know what you could use.
Pool 8.
That's still standing, isn't it? Bad location, though.
Say more about that bad location.
Yeah, but it's just, how are you going to get in there? I guess people wouldn't go there, would they? Is, at Pool 6, they had an office building there. Is that gone?
No, tourism.
Oh, they took it over?
Is using it, and so is the Marina Development Group.
Places I can think of is that old pool too, but it's very costly to fix that place up.
Mm-hmm.
Whew. It's been down for many years. What's the name? Freddie Burnell had he was going to build condos there, but whatever happened to him, I don't know. He's still alive or not.
And who was Freddie Burrell?
Brunel. You didn't know him?
No. What was his?
An entrepreneur.
I think I know this guy. He's a diver extraordinary.
Diver, he had everything. Sure, he was. Had tugboats, divers, dredges. Money went to good times. He had an uncle somewhere in Germany that sent him all the money till he came over here and found out where the money went. So, I think Freddie's staying in a motel now. That's what I heard.
If we do manage to get a center set up, and we're looking at the possibility of trying to involve Parks Canada, because we feel very strongly that the contribution of Thunder Bay's green elevators to Canada's prosperity is quite great and up to now not recognized. What parts of the elevator industry do you think should be featured, preserved?
All of it, I guess. Unloading of the cars, all that type of thing. We used to have, I don't know, SAS Pool, I think it was in charge of it. I don't know what happened to it. Have you ever talked to them about it?
Actually, we haven't.
It shows a boxcar tipping and all that, and loading grain.
So that would be...
I think SAS Pool had it.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What you do is bring some different types of grain, all different things. I don't think they had a ship there or not, but they had the old boxcar tipping back and forth with the grain coming in and sort of that type of thing.
Where was the trade show here in Thunder Bay?
Yeah, here at Exhibition Grounds.
Oh,
but
okay.
They stopped doing it, I think. I'm not really sure. I was part of it for a couple of years. Well, that's the part, yeah, with the grain trade. I guess you could say that part of it, yeah. Well, then you'd have to look at the people that worked in it, too. You'd have to have them, you know, going back how many years. How they started. Must have been horrific then, but. Well, then, what about Kiefer Terminal? What's towards Green?
There likely are spots available that are non-grain elevator spots, but one of the things that our committee is trying to do is to actually salvage an elevator so that eventually they aren't all taken down.
Oof.
You know, so that you make sure you don't necessarily have to maintain it, because they're pretty like that pool, too. It's pretty solid and it's going to be there for a long time unless somebody blows it up. So the external structure can be maintained and the actual facility that welcomes people can be off the elevator. Not, you would feature an elevator but not be in it. So, but we want to save an elevator because, you know, people say, well, we've got a lot of them. Do you need to worry about it? Well, you mentioned when we started talking about, you know, there used to be 25, 29. We're now down to what, five or six operating, and probably there was another one.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to.
That pool, too, would be, I'm not sure what the shape it's in or Buchanan owns it, but there should be space around there for parking, that type of thing, that's close to the marina, you know?
Yeah. And it is, from a grain elevated groupies perspective, very beautiful.
Historic.
Historic and beautiful. And
I'm not sure. Is there? Have you looked at? How's the docking space there? Is there?
That's actually the reason that Buchanan took it.
Okay.
Was for the dock. Certainly didn't need the elevator. That's my understanding, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Anything we haven't asked you that you would like to pour out to us?
No, I can think of. No, not really. No.
Ian, anything you have to ask?
Not ask, just you seem to have had a really wonderful sort of progression from the bottom to the top.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It has been
You're welcome.
A wonderful experience for me, and I'm sure for Ian, and I hope it's been a good experience for
you, too. Yeah, sure. I was curious about it. I'm glad you interviewed Bill Parrish, because I'm sure you got a lot of good things from him. Who else you got in Winnipeg from the grain trade?
We did George Richardson.
Oh, yes, okay.
Yes.
My favorite is Bushuk, who, I don't know if you'd know, he was a...
Ted.
He's a chemist, and his specialty was bread dough.
Okay.
And he spoke, I think we've got two or three interviews with this guy. He waxes poetic. He tells you everything about this fantastic process of bread making.
Yeah.
He's the one that sticks in my mind, but there were all kinds of people.
Well, him, Falling Numbers, I don't know if you mentioned anything about that. Did you mention that too, Falling Numbers in grain?
No.
When you put it through a test? If you buy a loaf of bread, there's any holes in it, they're using the wrong kind of grain for it. It's cheaper. It's not the good grain. That's called Falling Numbers. It's not up to standard.
The name sort of, some of them, pass me by, but you know, we've interviewed people with the malting industry.
Howard Hagland, I don't know, you didn't get him, did you?
No, who's he?
I think he's gone. He used to be their rep for Canada Malt down here.
Mm. Yeah. Any other names that you can think of, even within your own old group here, that would be interesting to interview?
Well, you must have got the local managers, didn't you?
See, we're not getting we're trying to get the people retired.
Okay,
and
well,
then
Bob McKinnon,
we got
Gerald Spears.
No, but I think his name is on our list.
Yeah.
You know, the place that we're really light, as far as I'm concerned, is laborers. You know, the folks who
worked.
Who worked. So if you
names.
Think of a slew of them, we'd really appreciate it.
I run negotiating committees and all the strikes, and they work different places, and everyone I know, they're pretty well dead. Just trying to think of some that...
That's okay. You don't have to now, but if you can...
Yeah. You have my email address.
Yeah,
just
okay.
Just pop a note to me, and because you may come across somebody in the street that...
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Well, thanks. I think we'll shut off the official end of the...